It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. How do you erase a projected $71 billion shortfall? That's what officials are facing when it comes to pension obligations for public school teachers and state employees. We're joined by investigative reporter Mike Wershagen from The Caucus, the Harrisburg-based newspaper that covers government and politics. Mike, welcome back to The Confluence.
Always a pleasure, Kevin.
What does that represent, $71 billion?
What that represents is the gap between projected out over the life of these pension funds, what they currently have promised employees of public schools and state employees, and what sort of revenue they will have to pay that out, you know, over the long-term horizon. And basically, it's you know, these are two pension funds. They're gigantic. And they're assuming an interest rate, a rate of return of about 7.25%. If they hit that target, they will fall $71 billion short of what they owe current retirees and current employees in the system.
So has it been growing, that gap? And if so, why so?
There are a lot of reasons. It has been growing. There was a time not that long ago when these pensions were fully funded. And as is so often the case in Harrisburg, people saw a giant pot of money. I mean, the state has to pay in every year to these pension funds to meet the state end of the obligation. You know, if you're an employee, part of your paycheck goes to your pension fund.
Right.
If you're the state, the employer, or the school districts, they're also supposed to be making these payments. You know, when times got a little tight, the folks in Harrisburg kind of pulled back on that obligation. They didn't spend as much money as they should have. And at the same time, they were passing some fairly generous benefits to state employees, to public school teachers, you know, that were part of contract negotiations, mm-hmm. things that you don't really find in the private sector anymore. You know, that state employees, they traded away immediate salary for this long-term retirement security. And the state didn't really keep up with its end of the deal. Now, you add to that the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, where the stock market lost a ton of value, and these funds are all invested in markets, mm-hmm. and they took an enormous hit. And they've been kind of scrambling for the last 10 years to try to figure out a way to claw their way back into, you know, full funding.
So the markets took a hit, but the obligation was still there.
Exactly. And that's the thing with a defined benefit plan. 401k is a defined contribution. You know exactly what you're putting in. You don't know exactly what you're going to get out. Defined benefit plan, these old style pension plans, you know exactly what you're supposed to be getting out. It's part of a contract, which is, you know, it has the force of law behind it.
This has been growing for years. They've been talking in Harrisburg for years about addressing this. Have they taken any actions, and what impact have they had?
They have. They passed a pension reform package last year that has put things on a much more firm footing than it used to be. Part of that, a big part of that, was switching some of these new employees into not just defined benefit plans, into these more, you know, some of them are hybrid plans where some of your funds are invested in the market and some are in this pension fund, or entirely in these 401k type plans. So that cuts down on the long-term obligation.
For right? The newer employees.
For the newer employees. And that affects the fund overall. So over time, as there are more and more employees who are in the system or coming into the system under these new rules, the long-term debt obligation, that $71 billion shortfall we're talking about, is going to start to come back down.
But can they address the defined benefit for those longtime employees?
They're working on that. There was a large commission study. They came out with a 400-page report late last year that had a list of proposed changes to these pension funds. One of which, the one that seems to be getting the most attention, is combining the investment offices. Now, we're talking about two funds here. There's the public school employees retirement system, and there's the state employees retirement system.
Right.
What this talked about was combining the management of those two different funds under one office. So you don't have two funds making the same investment and paying a Wall Street fund manager twice.
Is it simpler is better, or is it beyond that?
You know, economies of scale. You can spend less money, or you can get a better rate, better fees, things like that, if you are coming to the table with $100 billion rather than if you're coming to the table with, say, $27 billion. You know, this report estimated that if you consolidate things, the investment cost would be about 18% lower for the public school pension fund and about 22% lower for the state employee pension fund, partly because of duplication, eliminating that duplication, and partly because, again, you're coming up to a Wall Street fund manager and you're saying, I've got $100 billion I need to invest. They're going to look at that. They're going to treat you a bit differently than if you come in with a quarter of that.
why would combining two help out?
So proponents think it would help out because you're eliminating this duplication. Okay. You don't have two investment offices managing what are essentially both pools of state funding. These are public funds. You know, since it's all under the state anyway, why not just have it all under one office?
You talked with Glenn Grell. He's the executive director of one of the funds, the Public School Employees Fund. And he's a former state rep. So he has like a couple of interesting perspectives to take. So what's his assessment of this idea of combination?
He is conflicted on it, I would say. Or he's the way he put it was, you know, if you do it right, yes, you could have a benefit here. But if you do it wrong, if, for instance, the state legislators start injecting more politics into the selection and administration of this board, this oversight, investment oversight commission, or this investment oversight board, or whatever it ends up being. If this is a political process, if you politicize, you know, the investment strategies or who gets the contracts to invest these giant funds, then you're going to run into problems. You're going to make things much, much worse over the long term because people won't be acting simply in the interest of the health of the fund and the interests of the retirees who are going to be depending on this. Now, I should say that there are also already state representatives and senators on these pension oversight boards. So the state has a hand in it. They're overseeing it, which, you know, the reason for that is because the state is on the hook for so much of this money.
So Glenn Grell, executive director of the larger of the two.
Yep.
What is his assessment of the overall situation? Imminent crisis, ticking time bomb. What's his take on it?
It is not an imminent crisis. It is not a ticking time bomb, according to him. He is, in fact, he got a little agitated when state legislators described it that way. Mr. Grell is saying, look, no, there is a problem, but the solution is not to panic. It's not happening next year. It's not happening, you know, in the next 2 years. We're talking about long horizon stuff here.
Well, how long horizon?
Oh, decades.
Oh, decades? Not just a matter of a few years?
Right.
Because we've heard that.
Yeah. So that's the other side of this. One of the state reps that we talked to, Representative Frank Ryan, is a Republican out of Lebanon County. He used to be in corporate restructuring when he was in the private sector. His job used to be basically keeping companies out of bankruptcy. And so he's looking at these numbers and he's saying, yes, the problem is decades away. But because of the nature of this, because we're relying so much on interest, which takes a long time to accrue, to turn into real benefits, these problems need to be fixed now. We don't have time. Even though the problem doesn't manifest until 10, 20, 30 years down the road, if we don't get started now, there is the cost of actually fixing the problem then is going to be so enormous that the state will barely be able to bear it. I mean, $71 billion is an enormous sum of money.
Whatever solution is agreed upon, would the state workers and the teachers have to sign off on it?
I think that would depend on what the changes are. If we're just talking about fund management, I doubt it.
What about a combination?
That would still be basically fund management.
Okay.
Because when you're signing a teacher's contract, you're not necessarily saying, I want my money managed specifically by these people. I mean, we're talking about the health of the fund. And as we were saying before, this is not a 401k. It's not defined contribution. It is defined benefit.
What other reaction have you found in Harrisburg to any of these proposals? I mean, is there almost a hesitancy because you don't want to offend some constituents, teachers, state workers?
Well, yeah, you're talking about people's retirement security, right? And when you do that, people get justifiably nervous when you start talking about changing the system. Even if you're saying that this is going to shore the system up, you know, if you're a public school teacher coming up, upon retirement pretty soon, or if you're, you know, a new state employee and you're starting to pay into this pension fund, and you look at the recent history, you look at these political decisions that were made going back to the Ridge administration, Governor Tom Ridge and Governor Ed Rendell, who are making these decisions to, in the political moment, reduce the amount of pain they were going to have to deal with and make themselves, you know, look a little more electable or a little better for the statewide electorate, basically borrowing from their future to pay for their political present. When somebody talks about getting back in and tinkering with that system, people get justifiably nervous.
You have said earlier that there is not a consensus on when this crisis will come to a head, blow up in our faces, however you want to put it. But if we just keep going along the way we already are, who's likely to pay? The taxpayers? Whom?
Ultimately, yes. This is, the state has an obligation. See, all of us are paying into this fund now. We are picking up the employer end of the contribution because these are public employees and we are the public. And so it is our tax dollars that are going into these funds to shore them up now. And ultimately, the responsibility for meeting the obligations in those contracts falls on us.
What's your next question? What are you pursuing on this issue now?
We're keeping an eye on a few different packages of bills that are out there. The heads of the two pension funds and a lot of state legislatures are in constant contact. They are talking to each other about what they could use, what they could what they need to start chipping away at that projected shortfall, which could get worse or could get better. So that's something else we're going to keep an eye on. That $71 billion is, as we said, based on one particular interest rate, 7.25%. If that interest rate drops back to, if it drops back to 6% instead of 7.25, then that shortfall goes from $71 billion to $90 billion. On the other hand, if they start beating that number, the problem shrinks. So we need to keep an eye on the overall health of the economy, too, because it all plays into how big of a bill the taxpayers of this state are eventually going to be stuck with.
So that's 7.25%. Is that a conservative estimate, a moderate, or is this being aggressive, the expectation of payoff, if you would?
That also depends on who you ask. So you've got guys like Representative Ryan saying there is no way that a corporation would assume a 7.25 rate of return. But you've got Glenn Grell saying, we didn't just pull this number out of thin air. You know, we did our homework. To do anything in these large pension funds takes an enormous amount of time and research because they're not playing around. And so that number, he says, is something that the pension funds have put the work into.
Mike Warshagen is an investigative reporter for the Harrisburg-based newspaper The Caucus, which covers government and politics. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Nobody likes it when their favorite band sells out. Just ask Bruce Springsteen, who caught plenty of grief for the new, more commercial sound on his album, Born in the USA. Though the music had a bit of a pop flair, the lyrics were just as Springsteenian as they'd ever been, celebrating all sorts of working-class heroes, and the album's title track remains one of the most wrongly interpreted songs in all of rock music. Born in the USA was released 35 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Across Appalachia, more than a million acres of formerly mined lands are stunted, where native trees can't grow. Now, as Andy Kubis reports for the Allegheny Front, conservationists are using a new strategy to bring back forests.
Deep in the Moshannon State Forest in Elk County, Pennsylvania, there's a sloped patch of land surrounded by an otherwise healthy forest. The earth has been churned up with tangled roots and jumbled rocks. John Hecker is a forester for the state.
And as you can see, it's a very bare site presently. I mean, there's no trees here.
In the late 1800s, this area was deep mined. Later, it was strip mined. When the coal companies left in the mid-1990s, the land was abandoned. Then, about 12 years ago, the site was reclaimed. That's the term for the federal government's directive to coal companies to make mine land useful again. Often that's meant planting trees. But they didn't take in this area.
The technology back then was to just recontour the land. But the bulldozers, as they ran over it, they compacted the soil. Well, the trees don't do very well in compacted soil.
Hecker manages this tract of land. He says now this and hundreds of acres of formerly mined land in Pennsylvania are getting an ecological do-over. Reclamation 2.0, you could call it. That's why the ground is ripped apart. A jumbo-sized bulldozer with a 3-foot blade came through here earlier in the year and crisscrossed the ground with furrows.
It also loosens the soil where that furrow is, and it allows the tree roots to grow down into that loose soil where it's moist, and those trees will really grow well.
This aggressive form of bulldozing is a relatively new technique, it's only been used for the last 10 years or so. It's called the Forestry Reclamation Approach. Scott Eggerud is a forester and regulator with the Office of Surface Mine Reclamation Enforcement, part of the Interior Department.
This is not what they taught us in school. What they taught us in school is you pack it in, you put aggressive ground covers on there to stabilize the site.
And that's exactly what happened here. The non-native grasses they planted took over. They did really well on that compacted soil. But the problem was that the grass got so thick that rainwater couldn't seep into the ground. It might as well have been concrete. This new plan will change that.
Instead of water washing off the sites, it now infiltrates, and it's more natural, the way it was supposed to be, the way it was before mining.
A crew of professional tree planters was brought in earlier in the week to get the bulk of the lot planted. And now it's up to volunteers to do the rest.
Take a seedling out of there, put your hand around the roots, stick it way down in the bottom hole, then pull it up so the root collar, right where the root starts, just a little
About 20 volunteers with big orange buckets gather around Eggerud. He shows them how to put the tree in the hole.
When you empty that bucket, we have a prize for you. Guess what it is?
Another bucket!
Another bucket!
Yes. I love other buckets!
They're planting over 2,000 trees today. White pine, quaking aspen, red oaks, and black locusts. They're all native tree species. The Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources grew and donated them.
I think we'll plant another pine.
The volunteers fan out, navigating the jagged terrain while carrying buckets of tree saplings. 12-year-old Trey Slavonic is quiet because he's really focused on what he's doing. He's here with his dad and little brother.
This is important because it helps, like, with their helps like cover up all the mistakes people have done within the mining and taking the coal off from the top layers. It makes it then look more natural, have it better, and more habitat for the animals.
About half of this 45-acre site will be left as grassland. The wild elk in the region will like that. Laura Bray is the program coordinator for the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She's overseeing this reforestation effort across the state.
It's nice to have these edges where you have mature forest, and then you'll have some grassland, you'll have some wildlife shrubs. It's a good opportunity for us to make this site productive again.
It'll be about 50 years before there's mature forest here again. Scott Eggerud, the forester, says it's not just about growing trees.
The trees are an indicator of the quality of that site. If we're growing nice trees, that tells us that we have a very healthy ecosystem. You can't replace everything that was here. You replace the major components, and it just speeds up the healing process.
Now that the planting is done on this site, next up is the Gallitzin State Forest in Cambria County. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Andy Cubis.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Typically, you go to the doctor after the pain or discomfort or other symptoms present themselves. But wouldn't it be a lot better for you and your doctor if you were diagnosed before a disease became apparent? We're going to talk about pre-disease and prevention, specifically how that relates to diabetes and heart disease. Joining us in studio are Dr. Raghu Tadakamala, a cardiologist and hypertension specialist with the Allegheny Health Network. Diane Battaglia is a nurse who has been leading the diabetes prevention classes at UPMC since 2010. Karen Bryant is a writer, and she's attended that class for a few months. And also in studio is Oliver Morrison. He's a reporter for PublicSource.org. His recent piece on America's metabolism explores chronic issues and how to prevent them. Welcome to you all. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us here.
Glad to be here.
Oliver, I'm going to start with you. Tell us about the so-called diabetes belt.
So the diabetes belt stretches from the south through sort of Appalachia. It's one of these, it's just a stretch where if you look at the map of where the concentrations of people with diabetes are, it's red. There's lots of people with diabetes, and Pittsburgh is sort of on the edge of that. So we have higher than normal diabetes here in the area than in the rest of the state and in the country as a whole.
And that is not good news to be part of that belt, is it, Dr. T?
Well, high rates of diabetes are increasing. So certainly we want to keep an eye on risk factors that can develop into diabetes, specifically obesity and family history of diabetes, and get people identified early and see if we can help prevent this disease, which is a huge healthcare cost.
Mm-hmm. Diabetes, of course, a group of diseases result in too much sugar in the blood, high blood glucose levels. It can affect people in different ways. It often involves insulin and can strike after prolonged periods of obesity or even during pregnancy. It can also lead to many other chronic health conditions, acute incidents like stroke or heart attack. Now, to anyone, how prevalent is pre-disease diagnosis?
One of the big issues is that pre-disease is a relatively new concept. So for diabetes, for instance, it's only been around for a decade. So what that means is that a lot of people don't even know that it exists, or they don't know that they might have a so-called pre-disease. There's like 80 million people in the U.S. that are supposedly would be diagnosed with pre-disease if they have it, but 90% of them don't know that they have it. And so they don't know that they're at risk of developing it.
The thing about pre-diabetes is, just from my patient's perspective, is if they could have done something to prevent diabetes, because I am a diabetes educator and have been doing that for years, many have said if there was something I could have done to prevent this disease, I surely would have, because it's very difficult to take care of once you get it.
Right. And clarify for us, what exactly is pre-diabetes? Does it have to do with the number, the A1C level?
Yes, it does. So a normal A1C value would be like 4 to 5.6. But diabetes doesn't occur until A1C levels are at 6.5. So what happens in between there at 5.7 to 6.4? Pre-diabetes.
All right. Now, if you're in the between 5.6 and 6.5, does it mean you're automatically going to develop diabetes, Dr. T?
No, about 70% of people will eventually develop diabetes, but the important thing is not everyone will. So this is a potentially reversible condition, which is why we want to identify these people. And through exercise, good diet, weight loss, we can at least push off diabetes, if not prevent it completely.
Karen?
And I've had that said to me over the years by a number of doctors, and it sounds so straightforward and so easy, and then I found it impossible to make those changes. And that's why I'm so happy to have finally found this lifestyle balance program, because I feel like I'm finally starting to get my head around how to make those changes. If it were that easy, nobody would have pre-diabetes, but it's so very hard to do on your own.
We want to talk about the class and the support, the information you get, and so that you are not alone. But I wanted to ask, does that regional track record, the high rates of diabetes already, encourage the likelihood of pre-diabetes diagnosis? In other words, hold it, we're in an area where there are a lot of diabetics. So should that encourage more people to say, I wonder?
You know, you could even argue that pre-diabetes is not a pre-disease, but rather is a disease. People with pre-diabetes have a increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. So it's really a matter of threshold, and to some extent a matter of semantics. So I think what is important is to recognize that in any of these states that things are not right. They're not normal. The body is not functioning normally, and that we can fix it.
Diane, how do those rates, whether it's pre-diabetes or actual diabetes, how does that play out in your prevention class, if you would? What is the class like?
Well, we address, we do have a curriculum, first of all. It mimics the DPP, the National Diabetes Prevention Program. And we talk about different issues, as Dr. T had mentioned. Certainly diet and exercise are at the root of it. But because I am a professional, we are able to answer questions about cholesterol, stress management. It goes beyond just peer support groups. So that's where the advantage is, I believe, with program where you have a professional lead in the program. Questions get answered. That's why people come. They want their questions answered and they want to feel supported, and that's where the group and the peer comes into play.
So Karen, what's your experience been like?
Well, one of the things that's different for me, and it's been decades that I've been struggling with this, is that I have probably purchased every book on the shelf about how to make these changes. And I get a quarter of the way through and life happens and I get bored. But coming to this group and having someone like Diane who is knowledgeable, who can see through all of the excuses and has intelligent comebacks for it makes all the difference for me. And then having a few other people there is just really important to get their feedback too.
I got to sit in on one of the classes actually. It was Karen's first class, and it was just really fun to see the patients talk to each other, give recommendations to each other. So in addition to getting all this like information, the latest science on how to do it, they were like, hey, we're going to this like silver sneakers like class, like you should do it too. They were kind of making recommendations, encouraging each other on, talking about how much weight they lost, which I thought was really cool.
It's The Confluence, and I'm Kevin Gavin. We'll continue our conversation on pre-disease and prevention when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about pre-disease and prevention with Dr. Raghu Tadakamala, a cardiologist, Diane Battaglia, a nurse who's been leading the diabetes prevention class with UPMC, Karen Bryant, who's been taking that class for a few months, and Oliver Morrison, a reporter for PublicSource.org. His recent piece on America's metabolism explores chronic issues and how to prevent them. Dr. T, as a cardiologist and hypertension specialist, you often treat the end result of pre-disease, heart failure, full-blown diabetes, and more. How do your patients react when you have to give them that bad news?
It's interesting. We have people who come in with massive heart attacks who maybe didn't see a physician, didn't think of themselves as unhealthy, yet in many ways they were unhealthy. They may have smoked a few cigarettes here or there. They may be overweight. They may be obese. They may even had high blood pressures that were either not diagnosed or it was not properly conveyed to them that were abnormal. So oftentimes it can be surprising, and that's unfortunate.
Diane, you're dealing with people who have been diagnosed with diabetes or pre-diabetes. Give us a sense of their attitude coming in. Is it fear? Is it, no, I'm going to beat this. I'm going to, you know, be better than this.
So everybody has their individual reactions. Back to communities, it might be because of how your grandparents or parents handled the disease. Maybe they didn't change their lifestyle, so they're not going to change their lifestyle right away. You know, but I think once you show them that this is a way that you can be healthy, that you can improve your quality of life, that you can actually get back a lot of mobility that you've lost over time, that's also going to increase your quality of life again. I remember one patient coming in to class, and she could barely walk into the classroom, short of breath, you know, really dragging. So she came in and she took the sessions, and she doubled up on the sessions. So back then we were doing 12 weeks. She did the 24 weeks. And when she was done, she was planning a trip to Disney. And her family says, well, we're going to get you a scooter, Mom. And she says, I don't need a scooter. She goes, I can walk through Disney.
Karen, what did you think when you first heard of Diane's class?
Well, let me just say, when I first got some lab results back, because okay. I had gone to the doctor thinking I was perfectly healthy. I just, for vanity's sake, wanted to lose weight. And I said, please help. And she said, well, first we have to do an EKG before we even consider any kind of medication. And that's when heart issues, liver issues. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm finally retired and finally enjoying life. And now I'm going to be saddled with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think programs like Diane's are crucial. Physicians can only do so much in a 15 to 20 minute office visit every 3 to 6 months. And you make a good point that people respond differently to this news. So if I could tell someone that they're pre-diabetic, and hopefully they'll be motivated and excited to get it under control. But, you know, while fear and a diagnosis can be motivating, but it could also be paralyzing for some people. And if I'm not going to see that person for 3 months, you don't know what will happen in the meantime. And like you mentioned, none of this is easy. I mean, it's not like someone tells you eat better and exercise more and people start doing it and they lose weight. That's very difficult to do.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. I'm joined by four people engaged in the pre-disease and prevention community. Oliver, as a reporter, when you went into this story, what did you hope to learn and did anything surprise you about pre-disease?
I think for me, what was really surprising was just like as I started reporting on it, I started just talking to people in my life, like colleagues, friends, and realized like how many people knew so much more about this than me and were already dealing with this and thinking about how this affected their lives. And so I think there's just a lot. It was surprising to me like how many different people this was already affecting. But yet there's so many more people that really need this information and need to start doing more on it.
Are there warning signs that we just don't ignore? Maybe we think, they're just natural steps in aging.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we talk about blood tests, hemoglobin A1C, fasting blood sugar, checking blood pressure. Honestly, the easier thing to do is get a tape measure and a scale. Abdominal girth and increased weight are associated with all of these diseases that we're talking about. They've become normalized to some extent. So people have increased weight, and since everyone else does, it's thought of as normal, but it's not normal and it's associated with a disease, and we have to kind of change our mindset regarding that.
That leads me to back to you, Karen, and because you said, hey, I thought I was healthy, I was just going to the doctor because I wanted to do, and then you found out some other things. So were you not seeing some signs or not?
I was seeing signs in terms of how I looked in clothing, but I wasn't thinking of it in terms of health because all my life I had been feeling very healthy. And I do want to say that when I did get those lab results back and the doctor said, all of this is changeable, but it needs to be changed, I was frightened for about 2 weeks. And then I have to say that starts to dissipate a bit. And without a program to help keeping you active and giving you ideas, that motivation, that fear motivation, I don't think is enough. Mm-hmm. So thank heavens that there is a group. So
most people are going to be motivated by something positive, not negative. So it might get them started, though. So the fear of developing a disease or getting worse or whatever will motivate somebody for a short period of time. But to stay engaged in a program, you really have to think about what positively motivates you. Do you want to be healthy? Do you want to have a good quality of life? We're talking about decreasing the risk factors associated with diabetes. We're not talking about a miraculous cure for some disease. So, it's a tough buy-in for some people, too, not just the physicians to make that referral, too. So it's on both sides.
Is there a possible negative consequence of pre-disease diagnosis, whether the patient never develops the disease itself or maybe some unnecessary worry on the part of the patient?
It's hard to tell. Everyone responds differently to a diagnosis psychologically. The question is, are these pre-diseases even really real diseases, which they may be? And it's just a threshold that we were calling it a pre-disease when it might in fact be an actual disease. Like I said, even a blood pressure of 122 or, 125, which is, in the elevated blood pressure range but not hypertension, is associated with an increased risk of stroke and death and heart attack compared to a blood pressure of 115. So these are diseases, and they're associated with adverse outcomes. How we go about it is a different question. These situations don't necessarily require medications. If there are trials showing a benefit of medication, the medical community would proceed to recommend medications. As of now, we don't. We recommend lifestyle modification, which we're doing, but the question is, like we're talking about, how do we do lifestyle modification? And programs like Diane's are crucial. Unfortunately, there are probably not as many of them, and they're not as well known as they need to be. And the ones, you know, fortunately, yours is free. And that's, I suspect that's not a common situation. I suspect across the country, there's a lot of people who don't have access to programs like this or can't afford them.
Well, Diane, I want you to follow up. Aside from good conversations between patient and doctor, are there enough classes? Is there enough good information available for people to address these concerns?
So many of the committees that I've sat on of late with the Department of Health often ask that question. If we do get people mobilized towards these type of programs, are they going to? Or is there going to be enough of them? Are there going to be so many people? You know, and I'd say thank God if there was, but it's not going to happen. I can tell you that. So there's not going to be a big rush of people into these programs. But what I'd like to see is more referrals from the physicians, from the PCPs or cardiologists, that they know that weight loss is going to make a difference for their patient population. And I like to see more referrals come to them because it makes a difference when the referral comes from the physician as opposed to it's just a good idea to lose some weight.
So you know. Who's the onus on? Is it on the patient? Is it on the care provider?
It's both. It's both.
Yeah. Okay. As a patient, I think we have to be our own advocates. And our physician is our partner. Diane's organization or program is a partner, but ultimately it's up to me to be out there and educate myself, and I did, and so I ended up in the right place. Now, let's see what I do with it.
My final question to all of you is this. What would you say to someone concerned about the issues we have been talking about? Where should they turn? Dr. T, we'll start with you. Go around the table.
Yeah, I think ideally we'd talk to the physician, but then we always talk about a team-based approach to healthcare. So that involves not only the physician, but programs like Diane's if they're available, referral to a nutritionist or dietitian if they're available, referral to an exercise physiologist, joining a gym. But it's probably a process in evolution, and we need to find a better way to reach patients, meet them where they are, because they're not in our office most of the time.
Oliver, as a reporter, what did you learn about where people should turn?
Well, I think just the message I leave people with is that for the most people, it's just like they need to get tested and know where they're at, because a lot of people just don't know where they're at in a lot of these issues. And I think when you see someone like Karen come in and gets that information and gets it into her hands, then she's able to do something about it.
Diane?
I think that hooking up with a diabetes educator is a good place to go. It's scary to some people who have a pre-disease because they don't want to be associated with that, right? But I think that's where they're going to get the information they need, because the discipline is multidisciplined in itself. The diabetes educator has registered nurses. They also have registered dietitians, exercise physiologists, and social work. They have them all in that type of, and you have to find your right fit. I certainly can ask your physicians, but I'll tell you, a lot of them don't know about the programs, but I think that's always the best place to start.
And Karen?
Yes, I'm going to go back to my PCP and tell her what a good experience
personal
I'm having.
Personal care physician.
Yes, because I really want her to get the word out to people in a more efficient way than she was able to do with me. I had to really work at it. So I'm going to work with her.
So the final thing is, when it comes to pre-disease diagnoses, still early is better than not?
Agreed.
Dr. Raghu Tatakamala is a cardiologist and hypertension specialist with the Allegheny Health Network. Diane Battaglia is a nurse who has been leading the diabetes prevention class with UPMC since 2010. Karen Bryant has been attending that class for several months. And Oliver Morrison is a reporter for publicsource.org. We'll have links to his work on our website as well. And thanks so much to all of you. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, there's a new effort to better engage the public on autonomous vehicles. We'll talk to Karina Ricks, the city's director of mobility, about that and when self-driving cars will truly be self-driving. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.